The Agriculture and Natural Resources Appropriations Subcommittee will come to order. Adrian, please call the roll.
Chair Tomko?
Here.
Vice Chair Buchanan?
Here.
Representative Boltano?
Here.
Brannon?
Here.
Bouchard Cabrera?
Here.
Chambliss?
Here.
Clemens?
Here.
Fabricio?
Fabricio, here.
Hardy?
Here.
McClure?
Here.
Morales?
Present.
Ranking Member Umfroy? Representative Roth?
Here.
Stevenson? Tant?
Here.
A quorum being present, I want to welcome everyone to the Agriculture and Natural Resources Appropriations Subcommittee. Please make sure that cell phones and other communication devices are turned off or are on silent mode. Members, today we will begin with consideration of the consent agenda, then move into the presentations. Today we have with us Alex Reed with the Department of Environmental Protection, Director of the Office of Resilience and Coastal Protection, and Gil McCray with the Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission. He is the Director of the Fish and Wildlife Research Institute. As a reminder of House COVID-19 protocols, presenters are required to wear a mask during the presentation before the committee. Members, we are about to take up the consent agenda for the appropriations project bills. We will take up the consent agenda, vote once on the agenda in its entirety. The public is welcome to testify on any of the bills listed on the consent agenda. Members, we will not take up, question, debate, and vote on each of the bills individually. Instead, we will be in question and debate only once. Remember, you may vote no on any particular bill by submitting a nay vote consent agenda form with the administrative assistant before the vote. Members, in your packet, there's a list of the appropriation project bills. With that being said, are there any questions on the consent agenda? Seeing no questions, is there any public testimony on the consent agenda? Seeing no public testimony, is there any debate? Seeing no debate, before I call the vote on the consent agenda, are there any nay forms? Adrian, will you please call the roll on the consent agenda? Remember, a yes vote signifies an affirmative vote for every bill on the consent agenda, with the exception of any no votes on the particular bill or bills that were just announced.
Chair Tomko?
Yes.
Vice Chair Buchanan?
Yes.
Representative Boltano?
Yes.
Brannon?
Yes.
Bouchard Cabrera?
Yes.
Chambliss?
Yes.
Clemens?
Yes.
Fabricio?
Yes.
Hardy?
Yes.
McClure? Morales?
Yes.
Ranking Member Umfroy? Representative Roth?
Yes.
Stevenson? Tant?
Yes.
Members, by your vote, all the bills on the consent agenda will be reported favorably. Now we will move along to the presentations. Members, we will take questions at the conclusion of each of the presentations. Ms. Reed, you are recognized.
Can you hear me now? Chair Tomko and members, thank you for this opportunity to meet with you and give you an overview of DEP's Office of Resilience and Coastal Protection. The office was actually created just recently in 2019 by executive order. And for the first time in the agency's history, we have all of the coastal focus programs housed within one division. Currently, we oversee 5.3 million acres of submerged resources and coastal lands, and we manage 10 distinct programs out of our central office in Tallahassee. And finally, we can look comprehensively at all facets of coastal management within the state of Florida. We kind of naturally align on two primary focus points. We have our managed areas and we have our program areas. So I wanted to start first and tell you about our managed areas. We are home to 42 aquatic preserves, one buffer preserve adjacent to an aquatic preserve, three national estuarine research reserves, the Florida Keys National Marine Sanctuary, and the Coral Reef Conservation Program. Protecting and preserving the coastal resources in Florida is crucial to maintaining the health of our coastal systems. Those resources act as a buffer and a protection, and they're also the nurseries to our thriving fishing industry, and they're certainly an attraction to tourism from around the state. And when we talk about managing resources, we're really talking about seagrasses, mangroves, oyster reefs, coral reefs, and salt marsh, and all of the natural shoreline that you see when you go to the coast. And to keep these resources healthy, as you can imagine, we spend a great deal of our time focusing on water quality related issues and water quality monitoring, so we can judge the status of water quality and our resources and their health through time. Our aquatic preserve program actually began in with a board of trustees creating the first aquatic preserve in 1966. All of the ones following that, starting in 1969, were approved through the legislature. These lands were set aside for their biologic, aesthetic, and scientific value to be preserved for generations to come. They total now, after the creation of the Nature Coast Aquatic Preserve last session, we now total 2.6 million acres of managed area and associated uplands and islands. We can't talk enough about the partnership that we have with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. They're a wonderful management partner and also a funding partner. Our three National Estuarine Research Reserves are located throughout the state. We have one in the Guana Tolomata Matanzas is located in St. Augustine, and yes, it did take me a long time to be able to say that. We also have the Rookery Bay located down in Naples, and the Apalachicola is over in East Point. There are 29 in the country, and we have three right here in our backyard. These are managed and funded jointly with NOAA, and I will be saying NOAA a lot, and I do mean agency through most of this presentation. They all look at the four core program areas in the NERS system. We manage for stewardship, coastal training, education, and research. And what I love about the NERS is they are home to our sentinel sites and also our surface elevation tables. And these tools allow us to track sea level rise, sediment accumulation, and the migration of species along our coast. So instead of thinking about theoretical projections of what happens to the climate change, we're actually documenting that in real time on these facilities. They also help us with a lot of our sea level planning. And we've used both our aquatic preserves and our research reserves to implement a lot of pilot living shoreline projects. So we're doing a lot of research right here on our facilities. They're kind of I like to think of them as our R&D branch of the agency. And if you have not visited our research reserves, I recommend that you do. Their education learning centers are phenomenal facilities for locals and also visiting researchers. And each one of the centers kind of takes on the personality of the resources that they are there to protect. So they are quite lovely. And I've been really, really impressed with our team over the past year as the facilities have been closed to the public, and how our education teams have taken their regular curriculum, put it online, and make it accessible in a virtual world. So really proud of the team and how we've been reaching out during this difficult time. And I know we've spoken to you about the Florida's coral reef. It's the only barrier reef in North America. It spans 350 miles from Martin County all the way down to the Dry Tortugas. It really is a treasure. It's the nursery to fish and marine species. It provides an ecological benefit that is unsurpassed, and it also provides that protective barrier to billions of dollars of upland development. So it's really a critical critical resource here in Florida. We manage this reef through two different programs, actually, in our division. The Florida Keys National Marine Sanctuary starts at the Biscayne Bay National Park and moves all the way down into the Dry Tortugas. So if you drive into the Keys and you dip your toe into the water, you've just entered the marine sanctuary. It was created back in 1990, and we manage jointly with NOAA, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, And we partner with the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission to manage on behalf of the Board of Trustees for Florida. We do receive a lot of funding from NOAA for this management, and they focus on research, monitoring, enforcement, and marine zoning. And then as we look to the northern half of our reef, we turn to our Coral Reef Conservation Program. And they manage the northern reef from Martin County down to the National Park. The main focus point for this program is looking at impacts to the reef, such as coastal construction, a lack of appreciation and awareness, looking at land-based sources of pollution, looking at fishing, diving, and other uses, and then also focusing on reef resilience. Out of this team, located in our Southeast Regional Office, we also have a representative that represents Florida on the U.S. Coral Reef Task Force and the All Islands Coral Reef Committee. And as you can imagine, this focus group down in the Southeast has been leading the charge as we address stony coral tissue loss disease. Back in 2014, we first started noticing a very devastating and lethal, unprecedented disease in our coral reef. It started in the center of the reef and moved both north and south. And today we've seen impacts over 95% of that reef. And what the disease has done is it's targeted about half of the 45 reef-building coral species, and it slowly kills the living veneer of the coral, leaving behind only the lime rock skeleton of the coral. And without that living veneer, not only do we lose that ecosystem benefit of the coral, but we also lose the protective value, because that bare skeleton is open to erosion and damage, and it cannot continue to provide that protection. So an unprecedented disease has met an unprecedented response. I'd like to introduce you to our team members. More than 50 organizations and individuals have come together to help us battle this disease, from local, state, and federal agencies to over 20 zoos and aquarias around the country, to universities and researchers, conservation groups, private entities, and individuals. And as you can imagine, it's a pretty large group to wrangle, and so many different focuses of our response effort. It's been a phenomenal exercise to make sure that we're all moving together and in the right direction. So through the executive coordination team that includes DEP, FWC, NOAA, and the National Park Service, we work along with a steering committee, and we focus on 8 different program areas, from reconnaissance to rescue to research, propagation, restoration, and regulatory concerns. And then, of course, as you can imagine, communication and data management is a key piece to making sure that we're all moving forward together in a collective and transparent way. And I want to highlight a couple of the successes that we're having. Our recon team, these were our first responders, as I consider them. They were the ones out in the field marking the progression of the disease. They were also applying innovative and experimental treatments to try to stop the disease. Through an application of an antibiotic paste, they have been able to treat 85% of the lesions and stop the progression of the disease in 85% of the lesions treated. And those are for corals that were too large to remove from the system. They're also trying new techniques every day, and they're bringing back information to our researchers who are still trying to find out what makes this disease work, what's the source, and how do we stop it, and how do we keep it from happening again. Our rescue teams were going out both in front of the disease progression and also following the disease progression to collect samples that were small enough to take back into our laboratories and aquaria across the country. And we wanted to collect those species before they were hit to preserve that genetic material. And we also wanted to collect species that had already been impacted by the disease so that we could understand how they were more immune to the disease, and perhaps we could use that genetic material in propagation moving forward. We have seen great success in the laboratory with propagation. So far, we've been able to outplant about 350 baby corals that we've grown in the nursery. And we're planning, continuing that planning effort to see how we can restore moving forward. We don't want to take those samples that we have collected and preserved in the aquaria and put them back out into an unsafe environment. So we're very tentative about how we move forward with restoration to ensure that we have success. And one of the other big challenges of this is not only looking at those eight core areas that we talked about earlier, but also looking to the future. What is our long-term goal? And one of the long-term goals is to make sure that we don't have to go through this again. So we have a large focus on looking at water quality issues, land-based sources of pollution, and then having a healthier environment for our coral reef moving forward. And so those are our managed area programs, and I'd like to switch back to our central office programs that we run out of two different buildings here in Tallahassee, both the Douglas Building and also the Twin Towers down on the Bob Martinez Center down on Blairstone. Our Florida Coastal Management Program is operated in coordination with NOAA, and this program helps us collaborate and correlate our federal and state policy so that we're moving forward together. It's also a great opportunity for grant programs. We have the Coastal Partnership Initiative and also the partner agency grant programs where we look at projects focused on coastal resilience. We also, this is also home to the beach flag safety system, flags that you see when you visit the beach. And then we also have a lot of monitoring projects that come out of our NOAA collaboration. Our offshore and outer continental shelf program looks at activities in federal waters off our shoreline, also looking for state consistency. And we run this program in coordination with the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management. And when we're looking at projects, we're looking at things like oil and gas exploration, sand source investigations, military operations, and geophysical investigations as well. The Clean Boating Program is a wonderful stewardship-based program. We work with marinas, boaters, marine retailers, and boat yards to make sure that we're all talking about good stewardship for clean waters. This is also home to our Clean Vessel Act grant program that provides grants to coastal communities and also marinas to provide pump-out services so that we're not discharging into state waters. And the Florida Resilient Coastlines Program, I've talked to some of you about a little bit, and I'll just give a high-level overview. This program was actually begun in 2018, and it kind of had three focus areas. We wanted to look at an opportunity to create planning and guidance documentation for the communities around the state, and also be able to provide technical assistance so that communities could move with their planning planning activities for resilience in their state. We also wanted to start a forum around the state so that we could have resilience practitioners communicating and talking about innovation and challenges and issues and successes so that we could get that dialogue statewide. And then, of course, our funding program has been a great success. Since 2018, we have disbursed about $6.5 million for planning and implementation projects. We've been able to assist 129 cities and counties to move forward with completing peril of flood studies or other vulnerability assessments and some implementation projects such as living shorelines, stormwater retrofits, and natural-based resilience solutions. One of the challenges that we have right now is the development of the SLIP study tool and the rule implementation. This is based on Senate Bill 178, House Bill 579 from last session that passed, that requires that state finance constructors building within the coastal building zone should analyze that project for impacts for the life of the project or 50 years, whichever it comes first. And we're looking for impacts from flooding and coastal storms. We're hoping to have the rule development and the tool both completed by the end of this fiscal year. And then last, our beach and inlet management programs. We all know that beaches are Florida's brand. The major driver of our tourism economy is based on the beaches, on healthy beaches. And healthy beaches provide that protective barrier for upland development and coastal infrastructure, provides critical habitat for threatened and endangered species. And of course, it provides that recreational amenity for our tourism industry. And when the Beaches and Shores Preservation Act was created in 1965, it charged the agency with creating a comprehensive statewide beach management program that looks at long-term solutions for addressing critical erosion. So our team of beaches, inlets, and ports looks at activities below mean high water. Our coastal construction control line looks at activities above mean high water. The beach management funding assistance helps local communities apply for and administer grant opportunities to help with beach management activities. Our beaches field services look at compliance activities around the state, and also they're our first responders for storm impacts. And then our coastal engineering and geology group ties all of those programs together and makes sure that we're moving forward with sound engineering and sound science. And we are hopeful that next year we'll add another program to the division. The governor's budget has recommended the creation of the Resilient Florida Grant Program. And just like the Resilient Coastlines Program, this program would look at providing funding assistance to communities for both planning and implementation projects focused on resilience. There are a couple of differences with the Coastlines Program. We will be raising the cap for vulnerability assessments to 100,000. It's currently 75 with the Coastlines Program. And we're also going to be looking not only at coastal communities, but also at inland counties to look at their resilience needs as well. A main focus of this program will be to try to get all of the coastal communities compliant with the peril of flood requirement. The proposal also does include some criteria that will be used through rulemaking to prioritize planning grants. Obviously, complying with peril of flood is a priority for the state. Also, driving communities to develop adaptation plans and adaptation action areas. Analyzing for social vulnerability, looking at natural resource vulnerability. Helping to design regional solutions. And looking at those regional assets that are so critical. Also looking at financially disadvantaged communities. In addition to the planning grants, the proposal also includes funding for implementation grants, recommending a budget of $160 million for projects for the first year. The funding will be supported by $25 million in existing documentary stamp funds that will be used to pay debt service on a bond that will total more than $1 billion over 4 years. This program will focus on funding the incremental cost to help our communities adapt regionally significant assets to address sea level rise. So the proposal also includes projects that would be eligible for funding, and these include wastewater treatment, stormwater treatment, water supply, public facilities used for emergency response and management, transportation infrastructure, healthcare, affordable housing, and public education facilities. And a lot of people want to know practically what does that mean. So these are a handful of project components that make sense to me. You may need to raise the elevation of your construction. You may need to relocate to higher ground. You may need to build impoundment containment facilities for protection of infrastructure. We may, in some instances, need to harden shorelines. For water infrastructure, we may be looking at adding tidal check valves to the stormwater system, eliminating inflow and infiltration. Facilities may need to increase their capacity. And we also might want to look at water management opportunities that are incorporated with public green space. For green infrastructure, using pervious structures instead of pavement, introducing rain gardens, bioswales, and living shorelines, and of course, restoring our coastal wetlands. And the proposal also contains prioritization criteria for these implementation projects, including the elimination or reduction of coastal flooding. Have they secured matching federal dollars? Do they address areas that have been recently impacted by storms? Are there regionally vulnerable assets? Are we looking at regional collaboration? Are there innovative technologies to consider? Are we looking at building to a higher standard than current regulation? And are we assisting financially disadvantaged communities? And we all are also looking at the projects that will be more ready to proceed. We do anticipate that this would likely be a phased grant program, helping communities both in design and in permitting and in construction phase as well. And I thank you for your time, and if you have any questions.
Thank you for your presentation, Ms. Reed. And we have a question from Representative Clemens.
Yes, thank you. It was a fabulous presentation, and I appreciate you for being so in-depth. My question is on page 19 about the implementation grants. And certainly I'm supportive of the governor's budget and $165 million for projects for the first 4 years. But explain, if you can, the third point, taking advantage of historically low rates of, and you went over this pretty fast, funds are provided as debt service to bond more than $1 billion in total program funding for grants. So tell me how, what appropriation, was that in the appropriation bill last year to be able to borrow $1 billion to give out in grants through the various programs funded by DEP?
It's a fabulous question, and funding is not necessarily my background, but I'll tell you what I do know. The $25 million would be the appropriation for this year. That would be used to pay the debt service and bond so that we could essentially borrow $1 billion over 4 years. So starting with $165 million for this first year.
Okay. You're recognized for a follow-up.
Thank you. So I get the $25 million that would be in the appropriation package. What authority at the state can has the ability to leverage that and only pay the debt service? In other words, who gives the authority to borrow $1 billion on the bond market? Because isn't future legislative action required in order to fund the debt service each and every year? Or are we indebting the future legislations to a minimum of a debt service on $1 billion? So I'm just confused. You may not have the answer, but if I could get the answer, that would be very helpful. Thank you.
And you can answer, but I can also answer that for you as well. So this is the proposal, and we as a legislature are the ones who approve that.
So it hasn't been, Madam Chair, it hasn't been approved yet, the borrowing of $1 billion.
No, it has not.
Okay, I misunderstood the presentation. I thought it was perfunctory and that we were allocating the $25 million and it would be in perpetuity until the bond is paid off.
Yes, this is just a part of the governor's recommendation.
All right. Thank you so much for clearing that up.
Representative McClure.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Along those lines, just making sure that I understand it as we kind of think about it through session. If we sign up for the $25 million this year, are we signing up for the long haul here? And that's to say, if we appropriate $25 million, and I'm assuming that $25 million goes as a down payment on $165 million, but the total project over years is $1 billion. Are we signing up for the whole billion by doing the $25 million today? Does that make sense?
You're recognized.
I'm not entirely confident in my answer in this, but let me tell you, but what I do know is that the proposal would include $25 million for this year and then increasing $25 million each year to pay the debt service on the bond. I'm not certain what annual appropriations would be needed, so I need to get more clarification on that.
Sure.
And I can answer that as well. Each year, they would have to come back to the legislature to ask for that, and you are recognized, Representative McClure.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So then, if that's the case, that every year we'll have to come back and appropriate an additional $25 million, is this broken down, this first $165 million, in a way where we're going to cover a tranche of projects with that, and if for some unforeseen reason that, you know, this is my fourth session in the legislature, and we've had unexpected costs every single year totaling billions of dollars, quite frankly, that if we get to a place, say, in year two or three of this, and it becomes apparent to the legislature that we can no longer go forward fiscally, are we going to accomplish things along the way that if we have to abandon the balance, we will get some return on that investment, or is it if we don't spend $1 billion, we don't accomplish what we're trying to do here?
You're recognized.
I think every bit of resilience measure that we can accomplish in this state is getting us down the road correctly. There are so many threatened structures. There's, you know, we are ground zero for climate change and sea level rise. So every little bit that we do, every living shoreline that we implement, every base water elevation that we raise, we're moving ourselves down the road to a more resilient Florida.
One more question.
You're recognized for a follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And perhaps it was within this presentation, but do you have a breakdown specifically of what the $165 million in this year's, well, the $25 million that we would appropriate, and then the $165 total, what it would specifically go to this year? I think that would help me understand if that appropriation this year and that investment this year kind of meets that criteria that I'm trying to get. I tend to agree with you that any measure is productive, but you know, at what cost, right? So that'd be something that I'd be really curious to dig deeper on, if you can provide that today or maybe in a follow-up meeting.
You're recognized.
I cannot provide that today, but I can get you more information, and we also have to find out what projects are out there and then start looking at those prioritization criteria and see what our the priorities will be for those regional assets.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And Representative Roth, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for this presentation today. I am a little bit maybe just beginning to understand fully the intent of this resiliency project. One of the problems I'm having is on page 19 and 20, at the end of the last bullet point on page 19, it says that the program will fund the incremental costs required to deal with sea level rise, which is, I think, what everybody was assuming. But when I read all these implementation projects, I see projects, it doesn't just immediately jump out at me that these projects are dealing with sea level rise. For example, you know, public facilities used for emergency response and management, that could even be a coastal structure for discharge of rainfall by the water management district, where they're having to retrofit that project. So my concern is, I'd like for you to go in a little more detail, because it looks like these initial projects really don't deal directly with sea level rise.
You're recognized.
Thank you. That's an interesting question. I haven't had it put quite that way. I think that any building, any public building built within the coastal zone that has the potential to be flooded, we would need to address preventative measures to avoid flooding. Anytime you have a discharge of a stormwater discharge or discharge from a water management district, to your example, we need to make sure that as sea levels rise, we don't have flooding as a result of those discharge locations. Living shorelines implementation, natural shorelines tend to absorb water. We don't have quite the damage during storms and flooding when we have natural solutions in place. So it's looking at a variety of ways to address the challenges in our coastal communities. Does that help?
You're recognized for a follow-up.
Well, let me just put it this way. Maybe I need to make a comment. My concern initially when Secretary presented this earlier in appropriations, that maybe it was a little bit premature to start trying to do grant programs on sea level rise when we're really just in the beginning of the process of determining the impacts of sea level rise and doing those projection studies and trying to come up with a way to deal with it. I think my concern is that we do this in a very careful, methodical way and not try to get too far out in front of it. But when you look at these implementation projects, these projects are not really totally directed to sea level rise, but kind of additional impacts that would go with it because of an outfall from a sewage treatment plant or whatever may be impacted by sea level rise. So it's just, I think it, from my perspective, it requires, I think, a little better in detail explanation of where we're going with this resiliency, because we're just in the beginning stages. I apologize, there wasn't really a question there, but if you want to comment.
If you can answer the question that was somewhere in there from Representative Roth.
Well, maybe I just have a comment as well. So I get your point. I think that the planning portion of this new program will be designed to make sure that we're looking at assets across the entire state. And then I think that the opportunities for the communities, you know, we currently have blue sky flooding in communities. There are opportunities there to help combat that. We know that there are challenges with outfalls and stormwater discharge. We can start to address those. So I think there are, as we start to collect data around the entire state, so we have that statewide action, our statewide plan and snapshot, we can start working on the challenges that we know we have right now.
Good. Representative Tant, you are recognized for a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually have two questions. The first goes to your slide on page 17, and it goes into this planning process that you're talking about. So this might be not new to you all, but it's new to me as a new member. So the budget is recommending a $12.1 million line item to close the gap for statewide planning. So this map that you have here with the P's and the little round purple vulnerability, are those where the peril of flooding and the vulnerability assessments have been done or are needing to be done? I'm just trying to figure out if, like, because I noticed in here you have counties have not completed vulnerability assessments. So are these not planned for, or are these the ones you need to bring up to speed, or are these done?
You're recognized.
Thank you. Great question. I appreciate the opportunity to clarify. Where you see the locations here, those are communities that have either completed their peril of flood requirement and updated their comprehensive plans. And then the purple dots are where we've done other types of vulnerability assessments for coastal resilience. So if there's not a dot in your area, we need to come help you. We'd like the opportunity. So we're really looking at focusing on the areas where you do not see dots.
Representative Tant, you're recognized for a follow-up.
Thank you. My second question goes to slide 22, which you're talking about the resiliency, and I'm really appreciative of the fact that you guys are working on this. Yeah, you know, my county neighbors, the counties to the west of here, who were so impacted by Michael and are still struggling with it. So I'm really grateful to see what you're doing. My question is, we're talking about, and I don't want to deflect from it, the flood-resistant construction, which I know is critical. What are we doing, or are we doing, or does this even follow into it? Things like roofing ties and the right, you know, because what I'm concerned about is people are going to rebuild their homes exactly the way it was, and they're not going to be better for the next storm. So what are we doing about shatterproof glass, about, you know, or resistance glass, and then the roofing, you know, so that people aren't just going to be right back where they started from with the next storm?
You're recognized. Okay.
Thank you. Great question. I know that our Coastal Construction Control Line program works a lot with the Florida Building Code, the folks that manage the Florida Building Code, and every time there's an impact, they're looking at what works and does what doesn't. They update that code every 3 years, so that's a great opportunity to, again, assess with each storm, what did we learn, and do we need to modify the code accordingly so that we're more prepared next time.
Last one. When will the next assessment be for that?
I'm going to have to check on that. Okay. I'm not sure where we are on that three-year calendar.
That cycle. Thank you so much. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Representative McClure, you are recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One other thought came to me. Has there been any discussion internally about perhaps before we go and secure debt, can we find the revenues? Obviously, we're facing, you know, budget challenges in the wake of the last year, and certainly even before that with storms and other events. And so I'm a little curious and quite frankly, marginally concerned about taking on a debt load, no matter the interest rate, when maybe we don't fully understand the entire budget forecast. So is there a way to pay for this with existing dollars that would not require us to secure debt?
You're recognized, Ms. Reed.
I'm not sure I'm the best person to answer that. But we're happy to look at funding opportunities.
Representative Hardy, you are recognized for a question.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. You know, climate change is real. It's happening. The seas are rising because of it. We're getting more frequent, intense storms because of it, and we're going to have to adjust and prepare. And that's what we call resilience. What I appreciate about this Resilient Florida Grant Program, and in particular the implementation project examples that you put on page 20 of your presentation, is that it acknowledges that this is going to hit some people more than others, and that for some of those folks, they're going to have a greater challenge financing that adjustment, right? And so, for example, in the sister committee to this one, the policy committee, we got a presentation about, frankly, the new elevations that people are going to have to build their homes to in order to do that. That's going to add cost, and that cost cannot be borne easily by every single person who's going to have to bear it. Some folks are going to have a more difficult time with that. So with respect to the varied channels of implementation of this Resilient Florida Grant Program, I'm wondering, how are you going to coordinate with the other agencies that have some jurisdiction over this? For example, education, affordable housing, and healthcare. Are these grant programs going to be administered from your division or from your department? Or is this going to be something where you give the money, or at least the decision-making authority as to who gets the money and how, to some of these other agencies that are kind of over these things here?
You're recognized.
Thank you. Wonderful question. It is my understanding it will be administered through the Office of Resilience and Coastal Protection, but coordination with our state partners, local and state partners, will be crucial. It'll start in the rulemaking phase and go all the way through implementation and final completion of projects. So it's and one we're currently in a really good position to do that with Secretary Valenstein as the acting CRO. Gives us a great way to reach out and keep those open lines of communication with our state agencies and our local partners.
May I ask a follow-up?
Absolutely. You're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate that color. If you can help me out here, I'm a little hazy on the amounts that might go to the various implementation priorities that you have through this Resilient Florida Grant Program. Do you have any idea as to how much? I'm particularly concerned with affordable housing and also with education and healthcare, and the fact that this is going to hit some people differently, and you know, we're going to need funds for that. Do you have any ideas to how much might be allocated to each?
You're recognized.
Unfortunately, I do not at this time, and we've got to start by reaching out to communities and find out what the need is. Then look at the criteria in the proposal, and then look at how we're going to prioritize those based on those criteria. So until we know who's at the table and we know who's ready to proceed, you know, that was one of the last criteria, who's ready to go. Until we know that, I'm afraid we're not going to have the full picture. So we certainly have our homework cut out for us in getting out to the communities and finding out what the true need is.
Thank you. And one final
follow-up, and members, we have another presentation after this, and we still have two more members that want to ask questions.
Thank you. So the SLIP tool is very innovative. I think it's a fantastic idea. Folks aren't required to take the recommendations that come out of that analysis, but at least it's there. It gives folks something to think about. If some of the recommendations, for example, that come out of the SLIP tool add cost to a particular project, will that be a consideration with stuff like this from this Resilient Florida grant program? Some sort of inducement to encourage folks to take the recommendation from the SLIP tool analysis?
You're recognized.
Thank you. I hope that the SLIP tool can be used for this kind of application. I hope that if the community knows they have to, say, rebuild a wastewater treatment facility, and they go in and use the tool and look at some of the opportunities for building a more resilient structure, and we can document that incremental increase of cost to build a more resilient facility, we certainly think that should be eligible for this program.
Representative Stevenson, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do we have an accepted sea level rise expectation that we will use to evaluate these projects?
You're recognized.
Very good question. We are, as we've been going through the rulemaking process for development of the slip study tool, we are currently looking at the NOAA's intermediate high as kind of the standard that we may want to consider for statewide planning.
You're recognized for a follow-up.
Thank you. I'll catch up with you.
Great. Thank you. Representative Chambliss, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Excuse me. So, because I was looking at the map, and I'm looking at the Homestead Redlands area. And so if you could, real quick, just kind of walk me through the process of getting with your office and identifying an area, like you said, where we don't have a dot, but maybe we need to. Can you just walk me through that process real quick?
You're recognized.
Thank you. Absolutely. You can get with me, we have teams in our office that can actually reach out virtually and help any community to understand a lot of the training tools that are online, assessment tools are online, get you started in the right track to looking at your vulnerabilities in your community. There are five or six web-based tools open to the general public that can really help you understand what the needs may be in your community. We can get you involved with the grant program, the Resilient Coastlines program, to start looking at how we can look at peril of flood and vulnerability in your community. We have lots of resources at our disposal, and we're happy to reach out to your team.
Quick follow-up.
Thank you, Chair. And so, for example, when you say we, the municipalities in that area, community leaders, who as an example, who would be the we?
We typically work with planning groups, but we've worked with everyone from county and city administrators all the way down to engineers. So it really just depends who's leading the resilience effort. A lot of communities have really developed large resilience groups within their agency. Some don't have that kind of staffing capability. So we'll talk to anybody.
Thank you, Ms. Reed, for your presentation today. We really appreciate you taking the time to come and answer our questions and also provide us with this information. And I'm sure you will be hearing from some of these members with more follow-up questions. And now, members, we have Mr. McCray, who is joining us via WebEx. And Mr. McCray, you are recognized.
Good morning, Chair Tomko. Members, I'm happy to be with you this morning to give you an overview of our cooperative Red Tide research and monitoring activities. I'll share my presentation. Assuming that's coming through. Just by way of review, Red Tide is caused by a microscopic single-celled marine algae. The scientific name Carinia brevis, you might be interested to know, actually honors Dr. Karen Steidinger, who's closing in on 60 years of service as a state scientist working on red tide. Now, because it's a single cell, we often refer to the amount of red tide out in the ocean as cells per liter. So when it gets to the point where it's at 100,000 cells per liter, we have what we call bloom conditions. And these bloom conditions create potential issues for human health in two ways. One is that shellfish, which are filter feeders, things like clams and oysters, they can accumulate the red tide toxin and they aren't safe for humans to eat if they contain that toxin. It causes a condition known as neurotoxic shellfish poisoning, which can be a serious illness. The toxin can also be aerosolized in the air, actually floating in the air. And on beaches, it is that acrid smell that some of you may have experienced during a red tide. For most people, it's not a big issue, but for people with respiratory conditions like COPD and asthma, it can be a serious health risk. The toxin itself produced by red tide blooms kills fish. It can also kill wildlife like manatees, sea turtles, and seabirds. Perhaps the most common indicator of red tide in an area are fish kills on beaches. And of course, fish kills on beaches can create concerns relative to tourism, not to mention cleanup costs associated with removing the dead fish. It's important to note that the red tide organism is a natural part of Florida's coastal ecosystem. Blooms have been identified for certain since at least the 1840s, but anecdotally, hundreds of years before that. Red tide occurs nearly every year off Southwest Florida. The map you see on the right here is the number of red tides by region in the last 69 years. And you see off Southwest Florida, 60 of those 69 years, the red tide reached a level of that 100,000 cells per liter that creates bloom conditions. Bloom conditions are less common in the Panhandle and Florida Keys, and it's quite rare for the bloom to reach the East Coast because in order for that to happen, the bloom has to be carried by Gulf currents through the Florida Strait up the East Coast. Red tides do not initiate on the East Coast. Now, other states experience red tides as well. They can occur off of Texas as well as Mexico. So we've learned quite a bit in the last few years about how red tides form and how they strengthen. It's important to note that red tides form offshore. What you're looking at here is, if you can picture yourself in the middle of the Gulf looking north off of west central Florida, the mainland is off to your right. Red tide starts offshore, often at the bottom. And when current conditions are right, which typically occur in late summer or early fall, this red tide on the bottom can be moved inshore. And once inshore, that red tide can take advantage of nutrients that are in higher concentrations in these highly productive estuaries, including taking advantage of nutrients from the fish kills caused by the red tide itself. Now, this pattern of initiation and movement creates challenges. Clearly, it's very difficult to pick up a red tide early because it's happening at depth and things like satellite imagery do not penetrate to detect those red tides offshore. We have new technologies that can do that, and I'll highlight that in a moment. Just to give an overview of two of the recent red tides that we've had in the state, we had a very severe red tide from 27 to 2019. This was the fifth longest red tide on record. It lasted for 16 months. It impacted 22 coastal counties and some persistently. And this was one of those rare red tides that affected not only Southwest Florida, but the Keys, the Panhandle, and the East Coast as well. And the way to interpret these maps is the orange and red dots, and this is a composite on the left for the month of October in 2018. Those orange and red dots indicate bloom conditions. So this is a level of red tide where we expect to see things like fish kill and respiratory irritation on beaches. Now we have a red tide currently in Southwest, which is a more typical red tide. It started in November, and it's been confined mainly to Lee and Collier counties. The composite you see here was from December when the red tide was particularly strong in those counties. Right now, as we speak, this red tide has diminished significantly, and bloom conditions exist only in Lee County. So this is a more typical red tide that we're used to seeing, where the impact is focused on Southwest Florida. Now, it's important to note that although FWC takes a lead on red tide monitoring and research, it is a multi-agency effort. We work very closely with the Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services on seafood safety relative to red tide contaminated shellfish. I'll talk about that a little bit more in a minute. And the Florida Department of Health takes the lead on issues associated with the aerosolized toxins and respiratory issues on beaches. And it is Florida DOH that posts those advisory signs that you see on beaches potentially when Florida red tide is present. And they're targeting those respiratory compromised individuals that may want to manage their time at the beaches during a red tide. And of course, as Alex said, nothing in the ocean or even in freshwater is going to go well if you don't have good water quality. And DEP is a national leader on water quality issues. And I want to highlight the initiative championed by Secretary Valenstein and Governor DeSantis, the Protecting Florida Together web portal, which as we speak is pulling together data from all of these collaborating state agencies and providing a one-stop shopping, not only for red tide and other harmful algal bloom information, but for water quality in general. It's going to be a tremendous resource to the citizens of Florida. Just a little bit more on shellfish, because it is a serious issue and a public health issue relative to seafood safety. The FWC and FDACs operate under a biotoxin management plan that controls how we monitor and respond to shellfish safety issues associated with red tide. Now, the thing to know about shellfish is because they filter the water as they feed, they can concentrate red tide. So it does not take bloom conditions to create a potential health issue with shellfish because they concentrate that red tide as they filter feed. So for example, when cell conditions get to about 5,000 cells per liter, which is a level that you wouldn't even see red tide in the water, this triggers a potential precautionary closure that DACs may implement for recreational shellfish harvest, but also prompts FWC to do additional testing of shellfish in support of commercial fisheries and aquaculture operations. And we have very significant aquaculture operations for clams, for example, in Pine Island Sound and Cedar Key area. So this connection is very important, not only for recreational folks who may harvest shellfish, but also for those commercial entities and aquaculture operators to ensure seafood safety. And I'm very happy to say that this program has been extremely successful. We have not had an illness from consuming red tide contaminated shellfish in Florida, legally harvested shellfish for over 40 years. Now, we're very grateful to the legislature and Governor DeSantis for their support of our cooperative program. In 2019, you all funded the Center for Red Tide Research, which not only ramps up and expands our ability to respond to red tides, but also provides a network and a hub to bring in other expertise. And you'll see various partners listed on this slide that we cooperate with on red tide research and monitoring. And I just want to highlight a few of these folks. Our longest term partners for red tide collaboration are MOAT and the University of South Florida. Both operate glider fleets, which are autonomous underwater vehicles, which are extremely invaluable for getting offshore and catching those red tides at the early stages of initiation. And more importantly, these gliders can get down to depth and pick up that red tide at depth before it moves inshore and we're able to see it with satellites. MOAT is a tremendous partner for monitoring in Southwest Florida as well as the Keys, and USF leads the modeling efforts for red tide that predict where the red tide is going to go. Just a few more highlights from other partners. The University of Florida is currently developing an instrument to quantify the level of red tide toxins in the air on beaches. We have an existing monitoring program in place that relies on lifeguards to communicate conditions, and that information is provided on a beach conditions website managed by MOAT. But we really need to quantify that toxin in order to have a collaboration with medical professionals and provide good advice to those respiratory compromised folks who may want to visit the beach during a red tide. Other partners like UCF and FAU are developing technologies for automated detection of the red tide cell in the water column. I'll talk about in a minute how we currently monitor for red tide and how these new tools might help expand our capability. So this slide is just to convey some of the tools that we use. You see the underwater glider there in the center and the map in the lower right. The thing to keep in mind is that each of these dots on the map, and we monitor for red tide year round because as I said, issues with shellfish can occur even when red tide is not visible to the naked eye. A number of tools to get offshore and these gliders allow us to get at depth. Now in the upper right, you see one of our scientists looking at a red tide sample. And because when we get a water sample back, there's not only often red tide in there, but many other species of algae, microscopic algae that look a lot like red tide. So all of these dots that you see on maps and on our ongoing red tide status website, which is updated daily, Each one of those involves the collection of a water sample, the transport of that water sample back to our lab, where a scientist like the woman you see in the upper right looks at that sample and identifies red tide and the amount of red tide in that sample. So you can see how having an automated technology to detect red tide in the field and convey that data quickly so it can be posted for the public would be extremely valuable. The other thing I want to highlight is the collaborative efforts associated with two task forces. The Harmful Algal Bloom Task Force was established in statute in the late 90s. It was re-energized through executive order by Governor DeSantis and focused on red tide issues. So when I refer to Red Tide Task Force, I'm actually talking about that re-energized version of the Harmful Algal Bloom Task Force. And at the same time, the governor established the Blue-Green Algae Task Force. Even though blue-green algae relative to the issues this task force is dealing with is primarily freshwater and red tide is marine, there's a lot of overlap, especially relative to water quality, that these two task forces are dealing with. So the Red Tide Task Force has issued an initial report, a number of recommendations in four key areas: public health, communications, management and response, and research. And that report was provided to the governor and both houses of the legislature. And I want to emphasize that we have ongoing detailed collaboration with Chief Science Officer Dr. Tom Frazier and the Blue Green Algae Task Force on issues of common interest to both task forces. Now, over the years, there's been a lot of attempts and efforts to develop technologies and approaches to either control or mitigate the effects of red tide. The difficult thing with these approaches is you need to find a way to treat a red tide such that it either neutralizes the toxin or removes the organism from the water column without harming non-target marine organisms. It's a very difficult thing to do. The other thing that's difficult to do is to find a testing situation in the field where you can have the control conditions to understand exactly what the compound you're applying might be doing, not only to the red tide, but the marine ecosystem in general. And I'm happy to say that the legislature funded in 2019 a six-year collaborative initiative between FWC and Moat Marine Laboratory that focuses in on these red tide mitigation issues. And they've made tremendous progress in the first 2 years of operation. They have built a facility that is tailor-made to doing exactly what I said, creating those controlled conditions for testing potential ways to control and mitigate red tide and the toxin it produces in a controlled environment. So this can be done anytime without regard to whether we have a red tide out there in the field. So far, this initiative has tested more than 100 compounds with more than 20 projects underway. They have a diverse array of network partners and academic partners. They are guided by a technology advisory council. FWC sits on that council, and they have provided an annual report, their first annual report, to the governor, legislature, and you can get more details in that report. So lastly, let's talk a little bit about the budget that funds this collaborative effort. Our recurring funding for our Red Tide Research and Monitoring Program is about $6.6 million, and the pie breaks that down into three main areas: monitoring and event response, applied research, and then funds for the HAB Task Force and HAB Grants Program. The shaded areas in this pie identify funds that go to outsourced partners, that array of organizations that were represented on that earlier slide. So almost half of the funding we receive is pushed out to solicit that specific expertise from our partners. And then in addition to that $6.6 million recurring funding, there's time-limited directed funding for the Red Tide Mitigation and Technology Development Initiative. That's $3 million a year for 6 years. So that is in addition to the $6.6 million. And with that, Chair, that concludes my presentation. I'm happy to address any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. McRae. We do have a question for you, starting out with Representative Roth.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Mr. McRae, I'm glad I can see your face. I feel like we were being a presentation by a ghost, because like, where is he? So thank you for being here on screen. My question really goes to the great work you're doing here with the red tide mitigation. I appreciated so much the slide you included, number four, where you're showing the beginning or the initiation of the problem in depths down at the bottom, and then obviously moving up and coming into the coastal tidal area. So my concern is let me tell you what my concern is, and then I'll follow with a question. My concern is that the media often conflates red tide and blue-green algae. Obviously, your task force is called harmful blue-green algae, but it's actually red tide is the one that's toxic. But most times the media says that it's toxic blue-green algae, and that they also try to connect that they're connected. So my first question is obviously the red tide is more prevalent on the Gulf Coast because of the terrain of the coastal region. Like in Palm Beach County, it's 600 feet deep, 4 miles off the coast. It's not 600 feet deep off of Sarasota. So I just wanted a little more understanding why we typically don't have red tide on the Atlantic, and the connection to nutrients from red tide from freshwater. If you could address that, please.
Sure. First of all, I appreciate the question on harmful algal blooms, because it the terminology does get confusing. So harmful algal blooms is the whole suite of algae, both marine and freshwater, that may create harm in some way, either produce a toxin or bloom in such a way that when it decays, it eats up oxygen in the water, which is also a common occurrence and a sort of an indirect effect of harmful algal blooms. Red tide occurs in marine systems. And the blue-green blooms that we often hear about in the media can be toxic, but it's certainly not toxic to the degree that red tide is. And that they occur primarily in freshwater. Now, both blooms will feed on nutrients, whether at natural levels or increase from human activity. So that common connection with nutrient management is there. And that's one of the key areas where the task forces are collaborating. Now, relative to your question about West Coast versus East Coast and red tides, the West Florida shelf is the very shallow, very broad bottom off the West Coast of Florida. And as you said, on the East Coast, there is not a broad shelf. It drops off quickly. It is likely that it's that broad, shallow shelf that supports red tide in a resting stage. Certain harmful algal blooms can form cysts in the sediments. And it's likely that type of conditions, that relatively broad shelf and shallow water, supports red tide in a way that those deeper drop-off areas do not. So that's kind of the general view on that.
Thank you. Members, Representative Stevenson, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate this good presentation as well. In my area, we have the shallow waters of the St. John's River, which we've had some blue-green algae blooms, and they seem correlated in time with the increased biosolid dispersion on our lands in that area. Have you seen any, are you working with the biosolids task force as well?
That would be primarily under the blue-green algae task force effort. And as I said, our task force is focusing on red tide. Certainly anything that results in an increased load, a larger load of nutrients over time into a water body would potentially be of concern in relative to blue-green algae blooms. And there's a number of ways that can happen, including storm events, which can often bring a nutrient slug into fresh water.
Thank you.
Representative or Vice Chair Buchanan, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Great presentation, Mr. McRae. I had one question for you. You brought up aquaculture. As it relates to the Gulf Coast, where are we at with some of this, these environmental impact studies around offshore aquaculture. I know that's been something that they've been looking at as it relates to the impacts in and around Red Tide. Do you have any updates there? Thank you.
Yeah, my understanding is the state and federal fisheries managers who control the permitting for things like offshore aquaculture pens are at the point where they're looking to approve pilot projects. And I know that Moat Marine Laboratory and a number of other organizations are interested in conducting those pilot projects. And net pen aquaculture is occurring around the world, often at large scale. And I think it's something that will be looked at very shortly in Florida in that pilot project mode.
Follow up.
I don't believe your mic is on.
I think you may need to use the one beside you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So we do not have any updates as it relates to the environmental impact study around that pilot project.
We'll get back to you on that. I don't have the latest in front of me. As far as I understand, there are no barriers to implementing a pilot project at appropriate scale. So my guess is that some of those environmental issues that may negate performing one of those pilot projects have been resolved or dealt with. But we'll get back to you on that.
Members, do we have any more questions for Mr. McRae? Seeing no more questions, thank you, Mr. McRae, for your presentation today and providing us with such great information and entertaining our questions as well. And we look forward to those follow-ups on the questions that the Vice Chair had. This concludes our committee agenda. Is there any further business before the committee? Seeing none, Representative Botana moves we rise. Without objection, the meeting is adjourned.